I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Hello, this is Mike Swanson, and in a few moments, you're going to listen to another segment of Parallax Views. But before you do that, let me tell you about my new book, Why the Vietnam War. It's a sequel to my previous book called The War State, which has lots of positive reviews and Amazon's been out for years. But this one is a more detailed case study of how American Empire, National Security State operate using Vietnam. And I believe it shows also how things work today, how policy is actually made and why. So grab the book on Amazon.com, Why the Vietnam War.
Members of the jury, I will now read the verdicts as they will appear in the permanent records of the 4th Judicial District. State of Minnesota, County of Hennepin, District Court, 4th Judicial District. State of Minnesota Plaintiff versus Derek Michael Chauvin, Defendant. Verdict, Count 1. Court file number 27, CR20-12646. We, the jury, in the above entitled matter as to Count 1, unintentional second degree murder while committing a felony, find the defendant guilty. This verdict agreed to this 20th day of April, 2021 at 1:44 p.m. Signed, juror foreperson, juror number 19. Same caption, verdict count 2. We, the jury, in the above entitled matter as to count 2, third degree murder, perpetrating an eminently dangerous act, find the defendant guilty. This verdict agreed to this 20th day of April, 2021 at 1:45 p.m. Signed by jury foreperson, juror number 19. Same caption, verdict count 3. We, the jury, in the above entitled matter as to count 3, second degree manslaughter, culpable negligence, creating an unreasonable risk, find the defendant guilty. This verdict agreed to this 20th day of April, 2021 at 1:45 p.m. Jury foreperson 019.
Hey there, Parallax Views listeners. What you just heard was the verdict of the Derek Chauvin trial. Many have been celebrating it, but our guest on this edition of the program, the returning Arami Osei-Fringpong, otherwise known as the Funky Academic, has a bit of a different take. And no, it is not that Chauvin is innocent. Rather, Arami questions whether this verdict will mean a change structurally in American policing. In addition to this topic, we also cover something that Arami has become very controversial for, namely his criticisms of white feminism, arguing that many white feminists are beneficiaries of the current order, and that as such, white feminists will butt heads with black self-determination as a struggle. Arami and I also discuss the subject of being basic and why being basic will not lead to a happy and meaningful life. All that and more on this edition of Parallax Views with the always insightful and controversial Arami Osei-Fringpong, the Funky Academic. Washington, D.C., place of stately discourse.
Bare knuckle politics and all other assorted forms of scandal. You want that dirt on the Capitol? Then check out Washington Babylon. Shocking true stories and political sleaze, edited by Ken Silverstein. WashingtonBabylon.com.
Welcome back to Parallax Views. Arami Osei-Fringpong, the Funky Academic. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me back.
So this is your third appearance on Parallax Views, and I thought it would be a good idea to have you back on in light of the outcome of the Derek Chauvin trial. you know, for me, when I saw everyone celebrating, I sort of said to myself, is everything really going to change on a systemic level due to this trial, or are we celebrating prematurely? Do you share maybe a little bit of skepticism that I have about, you know, this sort of issue, sort of treating the Chauvin trial as, oh, you know, everything's going to change now?
Right. It's not just, I mean, the idea that you can get justice for George Floyd's death through a court is already a little bit dubious, just because, I mean, this is a whole life. Chauvin going to jail does not make me think anything is going to change about policing or the degradation that was heaped upon Floyd. It was a modicum of accountability, but that's, I think of it as a mob enforcer who gets locked up. The mob takes care of its family. Like, I don't think Chauvin's wife or kids are going to work for a job. I think I have a feeling that Chauvin's going to be rather popular, unfortunately, in prison with the white supremacist front. And usually it's not the case that cops are particularly popular in prison, but I think he's going to be very popular. I don't think Chauvin's life, I think he takes one for the team. He's a sacrificial lamb, and he's going to get taken care of. He's going to do his bid or whatever, and all of his people are going to be taken care of. And that's just how the system of white supremacy works. I was talking to a friend about, you have to watch out for these systems, because they can try to accept as much diversity as possible. That means they want black leaders and they want to punish white bad actors. They just also want to pick the black leaders, and they want to pick the white actors who are punished. And they want as much diversity as possible, as long as they don't have to change what they are, right? So that's why you can have, you know, Tim Scott down in South Carolina being a, you know, the black Republican senator, or any of these other things. It's just, you want as much diversity as possible, and that actually proves your strength and actually strengthens you, as long as you don't have to change what you are. And that means you want as many bad actors, white cops going to jail as possible, as long as it doesn't change policing as just the way, you know, we control like people we don't like and communities that we don't want to be empowered. Right. So I don't really feel anything different. You know who was really excited about this Chauvin victory? Liberal white women. They loved it. They thought that justice was being done, but you have to understand, like, nobody arrests liberal white women. Like, they're in the most carceral nation in the history of the world. It's really hard to be arrested as a white woman. It's like, I could put up the numbers are just appalling. They either don't break the law, or they're preternaturally good, or we just haven't criminalized any aspect of their life. But they were really excited that Chauvin was going to jail, because for them, the legal system works. Because like, nobody arrests them. I mean, I think you might have to like do cocaine off a police officer's badge while reaching for their gun to be arrested as a white woman. So like, they were very excited about this as like a sign of justice, but that's just because like, they like the police as it is, and they like policing as it is. So I don't really see sending a guy to jail as like a movement forward for black self-determination.
I wanted to ask about the whole mob enforcer analogy. Could you expand on that a little bit? Because I think it's actually a very useful sort of metaphor. I mean,
the idea is that if your mob gets caught doing something illegal, there's going to be a guy who has just enough juice so that it actually feels like the law is doing something, who will go to jail. And he'll say, like, he won't snitch on anybody else. And the mob that's outside of jail is going to take care of his family, fulfill his responsibilities, like make sure that his wife and his kids still stay at whatever school that they were staying at before. And everything's fine. Like, Chauvin's kid is probably going to become a cop. Chauvin's wife is probably, you know, she'll be fine. She's not going to lose her house because of this. Like, money will come out, and that's because everyone understands that this is just one of the price you pay for doing business. It's not going to affect business. And Chauvin understands that. That's why he's not going to say, like, the police trained me to do this, and I was I was, you know, if I murdered someone, then we're all murderers. Chauvin's not going to say anything like that because, like, that's part of the gig. And he is just going to do his bid like a good soldier while everybody else takes care of his responsibilities for him.
A lot was also made recently of Nancy Pelosi's comments about George Floyd, where she said, "Oh, George Floyd, thank you so much for sacrificing yourself for justice." I was curious as to what you...
That's like sacrificing the turkey for Thanksgiving. I like thanking the turkey for sacrificing. No, we killed him. So sacrifice, like, he didn't choose. Like, he was not a martyr. Martyrs choose. He was killed. He was murdered. He was sacrificed by us, because it took him being killed for anyone to listen to us, right? So he was needlessly sacrificed by us, by the nation that didn't take Black self-determination seriously. So yeah, Pelosi said, "Thank you for your sacrifice," as if he chose to do this. This was of his own will and for the greater good. But really, this isn't like... he was murdered. And like, honestly, we just need to figure out how to make... instead of thanking him for his sacrifice, I feel like the U.S. should cut like all of his family checks and all of his responsibilities. Like, that's like, he was murdered because we were obstinate. And that is that was the symbol that was portrayed. Like, he was murdered because we were obstinate. He didn't sacrifice. That's like thanking Iphigenia. Anyway, yeah, so like so that was horrible. But, you know, Nancy Pelosi is not a big fan of the poor. She thinks they exist in order to like secure her and her class a certain comfort, a certain level of esteem and money. And so, you know, in Pelosi's mind, George Floyd served his purpose. His purpose is to die to make her life and her aspirations a little bit less uncomfortable, right?
I almost feel like she was saying the quiet part out loud in some ways.
Yeah. George Floyd was a Negro who knew his role. Thank you for doing your job. You did your job for America the way you're supposed to do. not as opposed to, like, you know, running against me, right? So like, George Floyd is supposed... that's his role in society. That's what he's supposed to do. So like, I have a problem with that. One good thing about the trial though was you can go back and read the initial police report, where the initial police report was like, this guy was resisting arrest and he died at the hospital. And it just really shows you the importance of an exposition. Because without that exposition, you just get the police report. And since we've been all weaned on, what, 20 years of Dick Wolf shows on Law and Order and all of that stuff, you think the police report is just facts. So without that exposition, you just think that Floyd was resisting arrest and then died at the hospital, as opposed to like slowly murdered in the middle of the street, like while everyone was watching. And you gotta... so if Floyd is a... if Chauvin is a murderer, what are all the people who either stood by or okayed that report, right? Like, what are they covering up? Like, are they accomplices? Like, is it a racketeering thing? Is it a RICO case now? Was it a conspiracy? Because a lot of people, you know... Yeah, I want to know every name on that report and everyone who okayed that report and everyone who gave that report without actually going back and correcting it. Like, they were all part of some sort of conspiracy, now that the report's manifestly shown as negligent. So I think that is a pretty good media case about what does it mean that without this cell phone video and without the trial, the official record is that Chauvin was resisting arrest and died at the hospital.
So I want to touch on the white liberal feminism issue. But before that, I also wanted to say, with that point you made about a lot is made of, oh, we just need to diversify the police. And I've seen this in other areas as well. You know, if we diversify the media, there will be less racism in the media. There will be less racism in policing if we just diversify. And I feel that is not a fix for the problem.
That's not a fix for anything, because these systems get stronger the more diversity they have, right? So if you can get, black cops doing what Chauvin did, or black DAs doing what, prosecutors do, or that actually strengthens the system that keeps black people degraded as a class of people, as a racial category in America, right? So, this idea that you just change the faces at the top, but you don't change the system and the priorities and the organizational structure, that's just another, it's the black face. You get black faces like being the muscle and the face of oppression in the same way that Obama was the face. And I just talked about this on Rising this morning, it'll probably air this weekend, about how you got to watch out for black firsts or youngest. It's all the same kind of it's the same kind of move, where these people were just the best able to assimilate into the status quo and are going to be praised for that. And this is when people talk about Pete Buttigieg being so young as a president. And I was like, all that means is he was the fastest guy to get into a wine cave. He figured out how to get there and suck up to these rich people like 10 years earlier than most people usually figure out how to get there and suck up to them. So he's prodigious, right? And you can say the same thing about Macron or Trudeau or like any of these guys. So if you're just there and you're just the youngest or the first or the blackest person, it doesn't mean you're actually a revolutionary that you're going to change the system. It just means that you were the first and most eagerly and competent in assimilating into it as it stands. And same thing about J.J. Abrams or Steven Spielberg or whatever. So the idea, you just have to watch what we're lauding. And I've been thinking about where we get this ethic. And I think it's settler colonialism, this whole idea of trailblazers. And I don't even know if that's how trails work. I don't know about that. I think it's actually this idea that firsts indicate progress is a real confusion, because I don't want to hear about firsts. I don't want to hear about the first coal miner's son who became a billionaire coal executive. I want to hear about the last. I want to hear about the last coal miner's kid who had to worry about their parents getting black lung. Right. So I want to hear about the last, because that means like something had to change. Some institutions had to change. And I want to hear about the last person who had to suffer this indignity, the last person who had to suffer this injustice, and what had to happen to create the last. Because this drawing a line between the first and the last is fiction, right? Like, right. The first can actually just calcify a system that's not particularly just or holy or good.
So in regards to the white liberal sort of feminist issue, it's funny because I've had listeners that will email me after I've had you on and they'll say, oh, Rami just hates. Yes, he just hates these white liberal feminists. I don't think you really hate white women or anything like that. I think you understand that a lot of white liberal feminists are ultimately benefiting from the current system in some way. They can be woke on a bunch of things, but I've met some that are definitely not woke when it comes to the black community. And it's just a fact. And there is a participation between white liberal feminism and the system.
Yeah, we talk about the school to prison pipeline and everyone's talking like, well, yeah, these kids are tracked to go to prison. And everyone talks about the cops, but nobody's talking about the teacher. And they're married, right? And they both live in Yonkers away from black people. So like this idea that the problem is the white cop and not the white lady teacher is a problem, because nobody's actually setting these kids up for self-determination or the system that will actually like secure them freedom, right? So we need to actually talk about like all of the, and the literature's clear, right? The literature's clear about the origin of feminism as a like a racial category, and even patriarchy. So you have, what you have is de Beauvoir and even Friedan, like trying to work out a kind of feminism that looks to black and racialized people as oppressed, and saying like being women is kind of like, being a woman is kind of like being black. Right? So, I mean, so like you look for a model of oppression that doesn't internally come out of, elite womanhood and womanhood, the aspiration is already kind of classist, but it has to look to like racialized others for an actual system of oppression. Because before that you have paternalism, and paternalism is different than a patriarchy. Patriarchy is a family relationship that's mostly based on like a patriarchal caste above everyone else. And outgroups are like the most hated, not women, outgroups, right? Paternalism is like patting people on the head and like denying them for power because like they need to be taken care of. Like nobody wants to take care of the Negro. You want him to work, or you want, they're like disposable. Like, so like you can't confuse patriarchy with paternalism, and paternalism is degrading, and paternalism is an issue, but you know, white women have the longest lifespan of anyone in the whole world. Right. So like even in the US, they live the longest, they live longer than anyone else. So you have to ask yourself, what other oppressed class lives longer than their oppressors? Poor people do not live longer than rich people. Black people do not live longer than white people. But yet white women live longer than like a lot of other people. So maybe gender isn't doing what we think it's doing. It's doing something else. Not that, you know, white women get it all, but like they're living a long time. And that's a huge outlier, because a lot of people think that life matters. And so if you're completely powerless, you wouldn't be living that long, because other people would like exploit you in order to like make their life longer. But maybe they're the ones who are exploiting other people to get a longer life. So we just have to ask ourselves, how is this class of people? So gender isn't just what we think it is. And you know, the money and the flows, the reproduction of whiteness goes through women just as much as it goes through men. And so if we're talking about white supremacy, we have to talk about like the role of mothers and especially their role in keeping schools and neighborhoods segregated. Because if you talk to real estate agents, they'll tell you that houses that kitchens and bathrooms sell houses. So if kitchens and bathrooms sell houses, kitchens, bathrooms, and school systems sell houses, and we have a housing segregation problem, who do you think is making the decisions about like houses in these families? It's not just all these guys, right? Who are worried about kitchens, bathrooms, and school districts. It's women too. And inheritances. We're about to watch the enormous wealth transfer that is boomer grandparents dying and giving it to indiscriminately their sons and granddaughters, right? So that wealth transfer isn't going to be gendered in a way that is obvious, right? So we pretend that the fight from white women against white men is something like the racial justice fight. It doesn't look anything like that. Even the fight between poor white men and white women isn't the same, because like poor white men don't marry white men. And here's the deal. If you marry Jeff Bezos, it doesn't matter what you have in your bank account now, you are a billionaire. So the idea that like we don't expose, if your mother, and this is important because this is what happened to Bill Clinton, right? Bill Clinton, we have the story that he grew up poor. It turns out his mom married a car dealership owner and like was the richest guy in town, right? So Bill Clinton did fine because of his mom's marriage to some other guy, Roger Clinton, who wasn't Bill Clinton's father. So this idea that wealth transfers and power and privilege doesn't flow through women also, or is somehow degraded because it's connected to the men. I mean, it's slightly degraded, but not, it's still pretty comfortable. It's still a lot of money.
I wanted to add something here. I mean, I just think of the whole incident with Amy Cooper. And I mean, right. If people don't remember, you know, she called the police on a guy who, you know, told her that she needed to put her dog on a leash. And she knew exactly what she was doing. She made it sound like she was in distress, like she was being attacked. And she wasn't. She just wasn't. And she knew what she was doing. She was taking advantage of privilege.
She was ticked. She was mad. She was mad. And that's what happened. She was mad and she did what she did because she was mad and this guy was making her mad. And so she wanted to exercise whatever power she had. And it turns out it's no small number of power. There was a woman last week. I did this on my show. I talked about this on my show. She called the cops on her daughter's boyfriend because her daughter came back from had come home with some marks from fighting. Cause like the boyfriend, it looked like he had pulled her hair, and the mother called the cops on the boyfriend. Well, it turns out there's more to the story, right? It turns out they were fighting and they've been known to fight. And this doesn't mean that he beats her. This means that they fight. Right. So we don't know, like, and this is just, you know, born working class black and white people. So we don't know anything about like their relationship, but it's just assumed, well, this 16-year-old was beating his girlfriend when all of the documents say that like they've been known to fight, which means if you look at the data on domestic violence and intimate partner violence in black households, and especially in interracial marriages and interracial relationships, it's bidirectional, which means fighting is fighting. It's not the idea of patriarchal. It's not about power. It's about people who are pissed and can't handle how they're pissed. So they fight, which means, and depending on which study you look like, it's more often instigated by the women. We don't talk about that at all. Right. So, and because that's not the elite white woman's narrative. So that's not the narrative that gets spread out. We don't talk about like they could have been fighting. Right. So this mom calls the cops on this kid because he's fighting with the daughter. And it's known that they both fight with each other. And the cops come in hot. They scramble helicopters and all of that stuff. And they end up shooting him dead in the bathroom. Right, this happens in I want to say Ohio, but you can just Google it. Page is one of the people's last names. The mom calls the cops on to come murder the boyfriend, and the cops go and do that. And then the mom says, well, I didn't tell the cops I had a gun. Well, you go to the 911 call, and it turns out she told the cops that he had a gun. So every white person involved is lying. At first, the cops say that the kid pulled the gun and shot the cops. But then it turns out that one of the cops shot another one of the cops by mistake. And then the kid ends up dead. And so, like, we don't know. I want them to produce the gun. I want to see all of this because so far, every white person involved in the story is lying. And so this white lady called the cops on her daughter's boyfriend. And that ended up with him dead. And it turned out she was lying about, we don't know what she was lying about. We do know that the kids were fighting. Even the daughter admits that they were fighting. They fight, not that he beats her, that they fight, which tells me, honestly, that she scraps. And, I've just been around enough and I've been hit by enough women to know what a scrapper looks like. It's like, so like, yeah. Yeah, so... like they are poor people fighting and it ends up with a black boy dead by cop.
So I wanted to add one more thing here on the sort of white feminism issue. I recently had on Aya Gruber, who just wrote a really good book called The Feminist War on Crime. And it's fascinating to me because I don't think it gets brought up enough. There is sort of this thing that could be called carceral feminism, and this carceral feminism was led by white feminists who actually were basically siding with Reagan in the 1980s.
There's a book by Leah Goodmark who draws out the whole argument too, and carceral feminism is a whole thing. It is a whole thing because we don't arrest white women for anything, so they just assume that the police exist to not secure rights, but to secure their comfort. Because, so carceral feminism is an entire thing. And what happened was there was something called the Duluth model for domestic violence. And it was, Ellen Pence was the founder of it. She's based in Minnesota and Duluth. And it was the model that said, like, domestic violence is men versus women, and men want power, and we need to protect women from it. Right. So that was made famous in the 70s and late 70s. And it got a lot of grants. Like, it really became very popular because it kind of went with the narrative that a lot of elite women had about their own lives. And the problem was in the 80s, and Pence talks about this, it was really good for grants and it was very politically popular all the way up to, like, it got the Violence Against Women Act passed. It was very politically popular and it got a lot of grants. The problem is it didn't match up with the data, especially in racialized communities, where, like, people were fighting for, they weren't fighting for male power. Like, they were fighting because everyone was stressed and there were all these exogenous causes, right? There were the substance abuse, mental health issues, and poverty. It wasn't male power, and it was, and the fights were bidirectional. And so what this does is completely erase male victims of domestic abuse and abuse. And so, like, nobody talks about Chris Brown being raped when he was 8, right? He was raped when he was 8, repeatedly, or R. Kelly or Lil Wayne, all of these guys, we know them as abusers. We don't know them as abuse victims. And why is that relevant? Well, because victims become abusers, right? And so if you don't treat victims, they become abusers. And so if we actually are serious about getting rid of abuse, we have to actually talk about all the victims. But we don't want to talk about all the victims because that means we have to talk about all the perpetrators. And we don't want to talk about the perpetrators of child abuse, because the perpetrators of child abuse aren't always dads, right? The perpetrators of child abuse are sometimes mom who just, like, lose their temper and don't like being frustrated. And so once we exonerate women from being perpetrators of abuse, and we build up this ideological apparatus where women can only be victims and men can only be perpetrators, where women can't be both perpetrators and victims and men can't be victims and perpetrators, we confuse the issue in a way that, I don't know, seems good for some class, for one class of women, and for feminists, but it actually distorts the problem if we're actually serious about getting rid of abuse, both abuse against adults and abuse against children. So they're getting better models, more ecological models of intimate partner violence that don't just assume, like, male dominance because they want to be men, but actually, like, look at the truth of external stressors, which explains all but, like, affluent suburban violence. So if we're serious about violence and we're serious about actually getting rid of both child abuse and intimate partner violence, we have to get rid of some of the external stressors and help people cope with some of the anxiety about frustrations. We don't make the most mature people. And it turns out that when you don't make the most mature people, this is what happens. But that's not gendered. We don't make the most mature women or the most mature men. That's got nothing to do with gender. We just don't make the most mature people. And so we need to just be honest about the investment feminism has in the natural moral superiority of women and the delicacy of women that kind of effaces their role as perpetrators of violence, not just interpersonal violence, but also structural violence. Like, we will not get serious about desegregating schools, neighborhoods, or even jobs until we understand the gendered role of white women in pushing for segregated schools, neighborhoods, and jobs, because they don't feel like they should have to take their fair share of vulnerability in any way, right? So abuses of power look like interpersonal abuses of power, but they also look like structural ones. And I mean, there's good work on this. What's her name? Louise Newman. Louise Newman wrote a book called White Women's Rights, The Racial Origins of Feminism. And then Tommy Curry's book, The Man Not, is fantastic, Dr. Tommy Curry. Mary P. Ryan, Empire of the Mother is another good book. We just have to look at how gender is used to secure a racial hierarchy. And you can't deal with gender first, because if you deal with gender first, you end up just diversifying gender diversifying the system of the racial hierarchy. What you have to do is deal with race and labor first, and then figure out what gender problems are left over. Right? So, because they're going to look completely different. Like in a place with a federal job guarantee and like all of these, social safety net, the gender problem are going to look markedly different. They're going to be almost unrecognizable. And then we could see like what's left over with gender. But like in this world, you know, women pay for first dates and ask out people and like and take out asbestos and the trash collectors too, not just women in C-suites, like when 50% of, you know, trash collectors and all that stuff. So like this is stuff we don't talk about. Carpenters and then coal miners, all that stuff gets in your lungs and then you don't live as long. So, you know, the revolution might not be all rosy for women insofar as it's going to take away some of the perks that they don't really acknowledge that they have.
I was just going to add to that. I feel like when it comes to a lot of these conversations, a lot of people, including white women, including probably myself, because I'm a white dude living in the suburbs, I think a lot of people are really afraid of looking in the mirror and saying, how am I a perpetrator? What is my complicity?
And not just complicity, perpetration. Because complicity is like, well, something happened and I just sat by. Well, how do I profit? What are the perks? What are my investments in it? And that's the what are my investments in it? And I just, I love town hall meetings because town hall meetings are really where white people white like out loud. And town hall meetings, like you just see what people are willing to do to keep their school the way they want it to do. And like, it's not just men. So you just see what people are willing to do in order to keep the entitlements that they've worked so hard to sustain and they're going to sustain them against both the machinations of the wealthy and the justice claims of the poor. Right. So, and it's not, like I said, it's not just men, but if you just make it about, if you make patriarchy merely about male power, not like a family arrangement to secure caste power, then you'll get confused because you'll be surprised when a lot of like people you considered allies are not going to jeopardize, you know, their husband's jobs or their future son's jobs or their granddad's inheritance. Or it's like, it's both predictable and I don't know. Well, we have to, we're not honest about how the labor market is something that's fundamentally different when you understand that part of your mission to stay at home, right? So if you're in college and you're looking at the private labor market, the horror show that is the private labor market, and you're like, well, as an emancipated woman, I could either, and you know, the rich guys need to get married too. I could either marry a rich guy or, you know, go and work in the labor market. And that's what freedom looks like. That's a markedly different place from being a dude who like is pretty much going to the labor market and doesn't really have a viable option of just, you know, could be a stay-at-home guy. Like that's just not a culturally supported option. That's not a culturally supported choice in the way that for women, it's either way. So like that's going to fundamentally skew what you understand the labor market to be insofar as it's optional. So are you going to have the most aggressive labor policies? Are you going to have, like, are you going to be out there for a federal job guarantee as like the most important thing for like your life? No, you're going to have other things to worry about because the private labor market simply isn't the same thing for you as it is for other people. Right? So, and a society that's kind of organized to kind of take care of you, and even if it's in a paternal way, isn't the same thing as a society that's organized to treat you as disposable.
As detritus. So beyond just the gender issue, one line from one of your recent videos that really stood out to me, and I'm sure it upsets a few people, but I think you're absolutely right to respond this way. People will say, oh, well, Arami isn't for integration. And you respond by saying,
oh, no, I'm
for integration, just not on my knees.
Exactly. No, my wife is white. No, I'm a big fan of integration. I just want to integrate from the power down, not from the most vulnerable up, right? So the idea is that where Brown versus Board of Education failed was it ended up with a lot of Black teachers and Black principals either being fired or becoming assistant principals under white principals and white school boards, right? So you should have integrated the school board first and then like the leadership on down, right? You don't integrate the most vulnerable, the students, and then put them all under white lady teachers and like assume that that's going to do the job, because it was never going to do the job, right? So like, I am for integration. I'm a huge fan of integration. I just think that like, you need to be very careful to make sure that you're not asking people to integrate on their knees, and which is what a lot of diversity initiatives want Black people to do. We want to make our organization less white. We want to make it more Black, but we don't want to change anything about our organization, like as is. So this kind of circles back to our concern before about like having more Black police officers. Unless you change like what we want police officers to do and why, isn't going to change the problem, isn't going to address the issue, right? So I'm for integration. I just don't want to integrate on my knees. I think people should be able to integrate like into power, right? Not integrate under power or assimilate under power, which is why I think a lot of Black firsts, like the first Black person to do this, end up being the vanguard of assimilation.
What's so important about that point that you're making is you are telling people, you know, ultimately, you know, if we want to solve the issues of racism and the class issues in America, the people that are beneficiaries in this society are going to have to make some concessions and are going to have to make some sacrifices if they truly believe in a more equal and just world.
Right. Yeah, that's, you're going to have to take a haircut. You're going to have to take and not on your own terms. I get to decide the terms of your haircut. Like that's just a tough pill for a lot of adults. Like, don't think they should have to do that. Right. So like, but that's what justice is going to look like. It's not going to be a win-win-win. Some people are going to have to give up power and entitlements that they think that they're owed. And anyone who's not telling you that, who tells you that like we could grow, the rising tide's gonna lift all ships, is just lying to you and is probably doing it because you're paying them to and they're scared to tick you off, right? So, you know, when I was talking to students about this, I was talking to them about a related issue, and I was asking them, so if you're worried about what you're saying on your social media profile, how that's gonna affect your job prospects in 25 years, are you really free right now? And they're like, well, no, because I kind of censor myself. And so like, how much free speech do you really have if you're worried about, even if what you think is true, that it might hurt your job prospects in 25 years and it's going to like slowly like keep your mouth shut? What does that mean for your political speech? What does that mean about the realization of truth? And then you have to ask your question, who's actually free to say what they want? Well, people who are like generationally wealthy. Like they don't have to, if you don't have to worry about future job prospects because like you got the family business, and you're going into that, you could just say what you want to say. You could be like who you are, right? So this is kind of an asymmetrical freedom that's mediated by a job market because we're not actually honest or even particularly articulate about the economic conditions of political independence and political freedom. So I don't know. A lot of white people... well, this is a problem with women because white guys don't expect me to say things that won't make them cry. But what a lot of white women expect me to say things that like won't make them cry. And that's just not, I'm just not convinced that that's how justice is going to be done. And so this idea that we could have like a tearless process between here and racial justice or here and labor justice just is never going to be the case, right? So you're going to worship the tears or you're going to worship the justice. And people talk about white fragility, but what we're really talking about is white volatility. We're talking about white volatility because when, you know, we're worried about making people so uncomfortable about race that they pop off and do something that's like an abuse of systemic or personal power. We're worried about Kyle Rittenhouse shooting people, but we're also worried about Karen calling the cops on people. So they call it fragility, but it's really volatility. And everyone is kind of a hostage to white volatility around these issues. And, you know, one of the reasons why you had both Joe Biden, Tim Scott, and Kamala Harris go out of their way to say America is not a racist nation is because they're scared that you can't tell the truth to white people about America's problems with race. And then you could say, like, well, these are legacy issues. But then what happens when you redress the legacy issues? If you try to redress the legacy issues, white people will get mad because redress is going to mean taking care of some, taking something that they think they're them. So, like, it's actually just a racist nation.
So this ties into the last thing I wanted to cover with you, the Being Basic video. And I want to be a little bit provocative in how I frame this. So I'm gonna ask, in this society, or even like white people, white women, white men, white children, are even they free? Are they slaves to being basic?
Yeah. So there's this illusion that being basic will save you. If you just raise your suburban kid in your suburban house and like you just do what people tell you, everything will be fine. But it turns out that that's not even working out. That's not even working out. I was talking to some friends and, you know, things aren't working out for their basic kids. They're not getting into the schools they wanted because it turns out that like nobody really needs basic people at that level. And, you know, you're not going to be able to carve out meaning in your life by being basic, because like there's nothing about you that's going to actually be realized. It's all going to be you fitting into whatever institution, and then you'll be sad, so you'll screw up your marriage and screw up your kids. And there's this illusion that being basic will save you, but then I'm watching these people who are basic, one, not know how to handle frustration. They don't know how to actually be free. So that means they can't cultivate free, which means they have a weird relationship with comfort. And if you have a weird relationship with comfort and frustration, you're not going to be a very good parent. So you're going to phone in being a parent, or you're not going to do it very well. So your kid's going to be a screw up in a different way, in a way that you didn't predict or you couldn't predict. So like being basic, being immature isn't really even working out for white people in the way they want. It's not creating meaning, even if it secures them the house they wanted in the school district they wanted. It's also securing them the diagnosis and the antidepressants that maybe they didn't want, because like they can't wrestle meaning out of their life in that way. So it's never going to work for black people. So but like it's not even working for white people, because meaning is actually means like actually being self-determining, but that also means taking your fair share of vulnerability and chances, and like participating in the institutions of justice in a way that like being basic forecloses. So I don't think, and I think the data will prove me out, that being basic is even working for like securing meaning in white families. People who did everything they were supposed to do are still, even if they have money, are not particularly happy with their life.
So what's interesting to me is, I just wanted to get your take. When you say freedom, what do we mean by freedom? Because that word, I think it's used in so many different ways by Democrats and Republicans and everyone in between.
So it's going to be self-determination. Liberals, when they say it, they mean choice between given options. When I say it, I mean choice between given options, but also a fair say in the options that are produced. So you need options in the production that have your realization in mind. For example, you don't want to be the situation of a vegetarian who walks into a restaurant and now has a choice between chicken, beef, or fish, right? So all of those choices aren't going to amount to freedom because they're not reflected in the options as they're produced. It has to be self-determination in the content of what's produced, not merely the choice of given content. So what does it take for you to have a fair say in the production of the options that are produced for you to choose from? Well, that means you're governing public institutions, because the options that are produced aren't just options for you, they're options for everyone, which means you're also controlling the options that everyone is choosing for. That means everyone has a say in the options that are available for everyone else in a way that is like, you have to be vulnerable to people who might foreclose options you want for yourself. And so this is going to look like, you know, there's the El Paso shooter. Sometimes I talk about this with my students. The El Paso shooter, he wrote a manifesto. It's actually not the worst document. I'll put it in chat when I'm done. And because in this document, he was like, look, I'm going to shoot these people up because I can't take the way Texas is becoming, you know, they're taking our jobs and all this other stuff. But I can't take the way Texas is becoming ruled by Democrats and they're bringing their politics, and I need to preserve my way of life. And in order to preserve my way of life, I'm going to shoot all of these people. But what he's worried about is other people coming in and having control over the institutions that he was comfortable choosing between, right? So it's not just going to be choice. It's going to be having institutions that reflect your idea of what your life should look like. And that's the latter bit that liberals aren't really good at talking about. Conservatives understand this, but liberals aren't really good that, like, you need to produce the world. It's power in production of the world. And then on top of that, choice between what's produced. So
the final thing here, I promise to let you go after this. I know we went a little bit over time.
Yeah.
You were talking about meaning earlier. And, you know, I think people are turning to meaning in all the wrong places now. They're either, you know, being obsessed with getting that career and the 2.5 kids, or they're apparently reading Jordan Peterson still. So how can we achieve a sense of real meaning in our lives?
All right, so you have to be a functional part of a self-determined community. So hopefully that self-determined community is the United States, and it's going to be in different spheres. It's going to be in your family for that immediate freedom where they're not other than you. It's going to be in civil society where you're a functional part of a society that is emancipated from the givenness of nature, but has to work out how we all kind of accommodate each other through the market or production that's decided by the political system. But how do we accommodate each other in a way that produces, like, options for each other that we couldn't, that aren't just fixed by nature. All right. So people just think that, you know, you can get meaning in nature. But the problem is, one, these people have been reading too much Emerson, and they don't even know that Emerson went home on weekends to eat and have his mom cook his meals and do his laundry. Right. So nature isn't free. Nature is fixed. I know this because my dad's from Africa, where nature eats you. We don't romanticize nature where we're from. So nature's not going to provide freedom or meaning because it's going to be fixed by its own natural determinations. You can't decide with your relationship with a tiger, like, should we play tennis or should you eat my arm? Like, that's not something that's not going to be a matter of self-determination. You can only do that with someone who's free. Someone else who's not, like, under this wave of pathology or, like, massive desperation. So in order to be free, you need to be in a relationship with someone who themselves is free. We all have friends who are addicts and friends who are like, or some have some sort of pathology. In that case, you're in a relationship that actually determines your actions. You're not free because the person you're in a relationship is determined by, you know, their pathology. So your actions end up being determined by their pathology. This is why you don't want your sibling to have, like, a drug habit or anything like that, because it affects you. So being free is going to be tied to being in a relationship, and a functional relationship. That means you're actually mutually accommodating relationship with someone who themselves isn't under the sway of a pathology. And now these relationships are either going to be mediated or immediate. If they're immediate, that means the person's immediately concerned with you. You're on the same team. What happens to you happens to them. That's great. That's fine for some relationships. The problem with that is, in those immediate relationships, you're not actually free from the other person, right? So you can't make a decision without thinking about them. So that's why we have mediated spheres of freedom. And this is civil society, where I can, like, my relationship with my plumber, I don't have to worry about my plumber's mortgage or anything like that. I just have to pay them to clean my pipes. That's mediated, right? And they don't have to worry about me, like, you know what I do when I teach class. They just have to worry about getting money, right? So it's mediated by the market or mediated by money. So that secures a different kind of self-determination. Still mutual accommodation, but it's mediated. There are cops involved and licensing bureaus and all of that stuff, as opposed to the immediate freedom you get in the family. Now, political freedom is where we all come together as equals and decide what counts as family and what counts as individual civil society, and, like, what should we produce for everyone, right? So that's going to be a different sphere of freedom. So freedom's going to have these differentiated spheres, and, you know, understanding their differentiation is going to be kind of knowledge of freedom. And if you have this vague appreciation of freedom that doesn't understand its differentiated realizations, then you actually don't know enough about freedom to be useful, right? So this is where liberals get into problems, because they think it's all choice, as opposed to the realization in these particular institutions, these particular kinds of institutions. And you just have to understand the institutions and how freedom is structured in these institutions. And meaning is going to be the active participation in these kinds of institutions. And if you're barred out of participating in these kinds of institutions, or you have to participate them on terms that you don't yourself negotiate, then, you know, you're going to feel meaningless because you're just a tool of somebody else.
Do you think that there's a possibility that we'll break free of our current pathologies? In other words, is freedom eminently possible?
Yes, 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 because it's tied to reason, right? So this is, it's tied to the autonomy of reason. And you know reason's autonomous because words don't have to say what they mean. Not all words are onomatopoeia, right? So if autonomy weren't reason, if reason weren't autonomous, then all words would have to like mean what they sensibly like sound like. And symbols couldn't mean something that's completely abstracted from their sensible givenness. So we know reason's autonomous, and the autonomy allows us to be emancipated from, you know, the givenness of our nature. So we can figure out how to be with each other in a way that supports each other's self-determination. But we would just have to actually take mutual accommodation seriously. Because without mutual accommodation, we're just in systems where people are choosing among given determinants. And that's the choice between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, right? You're just choosing among given determinants that have nothing to do with you. And that's just going to give you the illusion of meaning and the illusion of free. And people are going to wag their fingers at you and tell you that you're free and that you're just being spoiled. But really, you're just on some level know that you shouldn't have to choose into your own alienation.
Well, hey, Rami, I want to thank you again for coming on Parallax Views. I love having you on. It's always an insightful conversation. How can my listeners support the Funky Academic and watch your show?
Yeah, so, you know, depending on who you talk to, doing what I do makes myself down quite unemployable. So you should go over to www.funkyacademic.com and become a member. Kick in $5, $15, or $50 a month. I like the monthlies. You could give one big donation too. That'd be good. But, you know, you can find my channel on YouTube. I do a show every Friday, 4 p.m. Eastern, around-ish. And I do a show every Friday. And I try to just, you know, give you the quality of political education that you might not have gotten prior to listening to my show, or this, if you liked anything you heard, this is kind of what I do. I go a little bit deeper than normal, and good every week, Friday, Funky Academic. Just go to YouTube.
Well, thank you again, Arami, for coming on Parallax Views.
All right.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Arami Osei Fringpong, the Funky Academic. As always, let me know what you thought about this edition of Parallax Views by dropping me a line on Twitter at ViewsParallax or by email at parallaxviewspod@protonmail.com. Producers credit shoutouts to Catherine, Nathan, Holland, Mark, Chase, Zach, Omar, Ted, Ben, Catherine, Brian, Gratz, Martin, Gary, Emilia, and Mickey. If you'd like your very own producer's credit on each and every edition of Parallax Views, well, consider joining those listeners in supporting me at the $10 or $15 tiers of my Patreon page at patreon.com/parallaxviews. That's patreon.com/parallaxviews. There is also a $1 tier and a $5 tier. Any amount will help. Your support is what keeps this show going. So if you appreciate the work I do, $1, $5, $10, $15, doesn't matter. Please consider supporting me on Patreon at patreon.com/parallaxviews. Again, that's patreon.com/parallaxviews. And with that being said, until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views. with Parallax Views. To Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.